Welcome to the Watchmen podcast, your source for all things related to the HBO Watchmen series and probably all things Watchmen comics. My name is Wendy Ryan.
I, as always with Wendy, am Carolyn, here today to bring you the Watchmen After Dark section. Wink, wink.
I am Vanessa, here to support everyone's opinions because they're always awesome.
And I'm Tony, and... well, I'm going to give a lot of Jaime Reyes information.
So today, if that doesn't give it away, today we are going to be talking about the Silk Spectre and Night Owl. To give a little bit of backstory, which I think everyone has some understanding. So Night Owl was based, according to Alan Moore, on the Carlton comics character, the Blue Beetle. Now, there were two Blue Beetles in Carlton Comics. The original Blue Beetle was a magic hero who had a scarab that gave him his powers. And then the second Blue Beetle, as we all know, was Ted Kord, best friends with Booster Gold, a very popular Blue Beetle. Silk Spectre, of course, was the only Watchmen character that was not inspired by a Carlton Comics character. I will post the quote from Alan Moore on the blog, but what Alan Moore has said in the past is that once he realized he didn't have to use all of the Carlton Comics characters, he decided not to use Nightshade. Is it Nightshade?
Yeah, and yep. He kind of like mixed her with Black Canary, and there was another one, right?
So we can talk about Nightshade, but I think she's mostly modeled on Black Canary being legacy hero whose mother was also a superhero with the JSA. And she herself was kind of raised in the superhero world. And then that's, you know, so there's some mostly Black Canary in there and then maybe a little Nightshade. And so we're going to talk about those characters. We'll talk a little about the history. And then we'll kind of dive into the book itself. And then I think we'll probably talk a little bit about the before Watchmen comics.
That's going to be everybody else, because that I unfortunately was not able to find copies.
I think we realized last week that the before Watchmen comics, although, you know, they're there and they exist, and sometimes they're written by good writers, they're still not all that great.
I read the Silk Spectre one and I was just like, I didn't really like it all that much. I didn't even bother to read the Night Owl one. I was like, well sorry. Wasn't my favorite.
So Night Owl is definitely, and that's the interesting thing that we can talk about Jaime Reyes a bit as well, because, you know, Night Owl is kind of still, you know, previous generation now, you know, where Ted Kord was also more of the, you know, 80s Bwahaha Justice League International. But that was even after he was came over to DC from Carlton. So who wants to kick it off?
Okay, so we're jumping into Blue Beetle, and I guess I will give people a brief summary of the character, or at least the original character, because my friends are far more, as you know, DC oriented. So when people say Ted Kord, I go, he's Booster Gold's friend. And people go, yes, and he also did this. And I go, what?
Mostly he's Booster Gold's friend. Let's be honest.
Well, yeah, at this point.
Barbara Gordon's one time, maybe internet romance.
We need more gay. We need more gay always in everything. In everything Marvel, but that's beside the point. Anyway, so the Silver Age version of Blue Beetle was a Mr. Dan Garrett, an archaeologist based out of Egypt. And he basically, Wendy was correct, he has his magical scarab. And okay, so I'm about to possibly make myself look ignorant. If there's anyone listening to the podcast, please feel free to tell me. But to me, these early 1930s comics smack of Orientalism, where it's like, you know, the mysterious far off, you know, East and mystery and magic and everybody's magical and there's no real sense of people and none of the characters who these people go up against are, you know, people. So by uttering the words Kajida, he can change into the hero known as the Blue Beetle. And to prove my point about Orientalism, his enemies included the giant mummy, praying mantis man, Magno Man, Mr. Crab, the Chlorophyll Man, Mr. Thunderbolt, the Eye of Horus, and Mr. Jarvis Cord. So Ted Cord was actually Dan Garrett's student, and then when Dan passed away, he passed on the responsibility of being Blue Beetle, but he was not able to pass on the Mystical Scarab, which gave Garrett his powers. So this is 60s comics, which I kind of get it. Again, there's that sense of these are the sort of, the characters who have that. But I would argue almost, guys, that Dan Garrett, because Dan Garrett's a magical hero, Ted is not magic, right?
No, and as a matter of fact, what we talked about last week is he's another one of those Charlton examples of Ayn Randianism, where he's kind of he's a self-made guy. He makes all his own money, and it's through his own industrialism that he gets his powers and his money.
So he's like Batman.
Iron Man. He's more like Iron Man.
Okay.
Not to mix the companies, but he's very, there's a lot of similarities in Iron Man to the Blue Beetle, although he did not really wear a suit of armor. More, he flew around in his little ship.
One of the cool things that I discovered in my notes was that many people are probably wondering, as I did when Wendy first introduced the Charlton Comics characters, because I thought that the Watchmen Comics characters were just based on general comic tropes, that, why are these characters come from somewhere? They were copied by someone. And yes, Charlton Comics characters are in the public domain, guys. That means that they can be legally used by anybody. And that's because of a lack of a proper copyright notice. Any works published without a proper copyright notice between 1923 and 1977 are in the public domain. You'll note that there are some exceptions. Mickey Mouse! Mickey Mouse! That was 1927, but that, I think, any without a proper copyright notice, that, so anybody could write about these characters, and the fact that Moore decided to choose Blue Beetle for this. Do you think?
At the time, DC bought the rights from Carlton because it was not public domain at the time. But I do wonder, I'm not sure in the legality about this, someone can write in and tell us if that had something to do why they allowed the original Ted Cord Blue Beetle to be killed off, because making Jaime Reyes, who we'll talk about in a minute, makes a new character that then is under DC Comics copyright.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, and honestly, it was a smart move, because you have DC, Jaime Reyes adds a degree of, representation as well as everything else. I can go into Ted Cord too. Who wants me to go into Ted Cord? Anyone?
Oh, I love Ted Cord.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you can go. I'm not as familiar with him.
So Ted Cord became Beetle after his mentor Dan Garrett died and took all the magic with him. Thanks, Dan. He was killed in battle with androids created by Ted's Uncle Jarvis. Now, any Marvel fans who happen to be listening to this podcast like me and feel like they're on the wrong side of the tracks here might go, Jarvis? But it was one of those deathbed confessionals and everything else, and Ted essentially did exactly like everybody said. He's physically trained, practicing with his equipment, and finishing all of these experiments and all kinds of other stuff, and he's just a genius level inventor. Now, my question for all of my DC Comics cohorts here is, why are there so many characters like this in DC Comics? Oh, and he's created by Steve Ditko, so there's definitely that Ayn Rand aspect to him too.
Yeah. Ditko is a large part of the reason why there are a lot of characters like this in DC Comics. It goes back to that kind of, 50s, post-war, you can be a self-made man, American dream, survival of the fittest. There are a lot of these, like, manly men just, do it. And I think we'll talk. There's a lot of similarities between Ted Cord and Peter Cannon, who is the inspiration for Ozymandias, we'll talk about next week, down to the Orientalism and the magic, which I guess was Dan Garrett. But the Orientalism and the magic and the self-made and the using your brain, you know, peak mental and physical fitness kind of idealism. It's you know, there is a little bit of that, like, Übermensch, right, mentality still in there, whereas, yes, we fought the Nazis in World War II, but we weren't exactly above it ourselves.
Oh, that makes sense.
So, hold on, sorry. I bought this book, DC's A Visual Comic History, in 2014, and literally forgot about it. It's been sitting on my bookshelf for 4 years, 5 years. Just started reading it the last couple of years. So it literally goes year by year of DC's history, like comic book by comic book, like event by event, whatever. The 50s, 40s, 50s, like the post World War II era and the McCarthyism and the trials and all that, had such an impact on comics during that time. Mm-hmm. They had to, like, so many comics and companies died because they couldn't even meet the comic code or whatever. Yep. And so it basically, like, everything became, it started gearing more towards that black and white, all that, all the weird, spooky horror, all the, with the occultism, all that stuff kind of got peeled back because of that era. It was very, like, nothing out of the ordinary. Everything has to be normal. Everything has to conform. So I thought that was super interesting, and in how that changed the next decade to two decades of comics, and how certain characters had to literally disappear for 30 years because they couldn't even be, yep. They couldn't fit in that current era. So I thought that was interesting. Yep. But yeah, I feel like that kind of applies to that a little bit.
When Carolyn and I did the Swamp Thing Radio, which everyone should go back and listen, the first episode we talked about Comics Code Authority, and we even, you know, told a story about how one of the comic book characters referred to Marv Wolfman, and they didn't want to give the comic a Comics Code approval because it mentioned Wolfman. So they had to take that. But I mean, a lot of it was put in to you know, support racism and gender inequality, and mm-hmm. you know, if there were anything that went beyond what the moral code of the Comics Code Authority, and it wasn't even written. I mean, the stuff that was written down seems like, all right, well, that makes a little bit of sense, but the stuff they actually used it to keep out of comics was stuff that it's disgusting. Mm-hmm. it was censorship, you know, plain and simple, by, you know, white males who wanted to keep their power. Sorry, white males.
It's interesting that you bring the idea up, though, because there is a subtle reference when we jump into Silk Spectre. There's a subtle reference in Watchmen involving the Tijuana Bibles that I want to talk about, because, you know, we'll give you a spoiler warning and we'll give you an adult warning, because these are really fascinating little books. As for the Comics Code stuff, it's also important you guys to remember, especially with things like Comicsgate and with things like all of those other social justice warrior quotation marks things that are supposedly ruining comics, the Comics Code Authority was not lifted for, like, many of the major publishers until the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially,
large parts of it, I'm going to tell you this because I've lived through it, large parts of it came out in the late 80s. That's why you see things like trans characters in the Legion, like lesbian and gay relationships, like a lot more interracial relationships. I mean, things that just were not allowed before, even though it was kind of soft bands, right? But you were able to do a lot more. Yes, it didn't completely die until about 20 years ago. But you can see, you know, obviously the 90s was definitely a reaction to that, you know,
yeah.
Just coming out of Watchmen, you know, having that kind of, you know, reaction against all of the oppression that had gone on for so long. You know, the other thing I want to point out as we move along here is that the late 80s was 30 years ago. And a lot of these people are saying comics like when I was a kid are under 30.
Yeah.
So, you know, the comics in the late 80s, early 90s is in an extreme reaction to something. And maybe they didn't get it all right, because this was the first time you were seeing a lot of representation in comics. They did not get it all right. But you were seeing it, you know, and it was starting to be there. So, I mean, this is, you know, we're righting wrongs that went on for a very long time.
So I also want to bring up,
unfortunately unrelated to that because it's true, but it's a very interesting fact about DC. Fellow Watchmen podcast hosts, who do you think had had Archie the Flying Owl that was copied? Do you think it was Ted Kord, or do you think it was Dan Garrett who introduced the idea of a flying ship?
I would guess Ted, but since you're asking, it makes me think it was Dan.
I have no idea. I'm not even going to try to answer that.
No, you're right. You're right. It's Ted, and it's interesting because Blue Beetle Dan Garrett is originally credited as the inspiration for Night Owl, but Ted Kord, who is the character who is, who's the one that just got killed off to do Jamie Reyes and everything else, I feel like that might lend credence to your theory, Wendy, about not having the rights to Blue Beetle, or at least having something going on with that, because he really was they drew enough from both of those characters, and I think more blended them sort of into one. Now, for people who have read the comic book, and then you know how you have two different versions of Night Owl. You have the first version of Night Owl who's a cop, and you have the second version of Night Owl who is more of an inventor. I think that's also kind of a parallel for Garrett mm-hmm. and for Kord, because Garrett did invent a whole bunch of stuff, but he was more kind of a brawler. And then Kord was definitely much more of a thinking man who still happened to be a brawler because, shockingly, people can think. I bring up Night Owl in particular because there's the new trailer that's out. And we see that our lead character is also a police officer, just like the original Night Owl. Do you guys think that that'll have any influence on her character?
You want to go or should I go?
Yeah.
Okay, specifically on like whether it'll influence her or not, I do think it's kind of like it's obviously a reference to, but I think it's more how they framed, like they're going to use her to kind of show the police side in the universe versus having her be like really similar to him in a way, but it is kind of, it's neat for sure that they even thought to do it like that.
Do we think, so the question still remains, and I can't give any answer until I know, is it going to be, and I think it is going to be a sequel, even though they're kind of saying it's not really a sequel.
No, he said
or
it was.
And then the other question is, is it a modern retelling? Like, are we actually looking at a modern retelling? Because if not, I think it's, seems of a cop who thinks he can do more as a vigilante, that's a really, because his is kind of a really interesting story in that way, that he was always a crime fighter, that's who he was. Mm-hmm. And he had an exhibitionist side, which some of the people were just exhibitionists, but he was, you felt like he really had that code, kind of like a Captain America kind of code.
And what I think is interesting that the question of the trailers keep asking is when vigilantes, both vigilantes and cops, are wearing masks in their future in this show, what's the difference? What can you tell? And that's what I think is the most interesting thing is because the Regina's character, the lead, Angela, is a cop. She's a cop, but she's also now full on masked out, looking literally like a vigilante, acting out like a vigilante. What's the difference at this point? And I want to see, literally, I want to see the show address that. Like, what are the difference between the cops and the vigilantes at this point? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Absolutely. This is a question for our age. When you see cops going off and going way beyond, what the book tells them to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think stepping outside of maybe where they should be, and where's the line? You get a little bit. How much is it taking justice into your own hands versus executing the law?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you bring up, as we talk about, the relationship between masks and vigilantes, and I say this fully aware as a comic book fan, the sort of strange perversion that comes with the worship of these characters that have fallen, that are half god/mythological figure, and half, you know, truthfully, like they've been used in history as a, you know, as a descriptor for people who are perverts. And, you know, I'm looking at my list of the original Watchmen characters, and we've got the Silhouette, who Ursula Zant, who was, according to the first Night Owl, she went public with her career as a superhero, and she was also gay, if you remember the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also, and which was a great little twist, because she was the one who kissed the nurse instead of the guy in this world, if you guys don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hooded Justice, as well as Captain Metropolis, had a relationship. And I would like to, so they were also gay. So there was a lot of, like, you know, these people working out these urges and things like that. I would like to see, and I want to postulate this, I would like to see Hollis, the original Hollis, turn out to have some issues with blurring the line between vigilante and police officer. Because... Mm-hmm. Hollis always seemed, thinking of it in terms of trying to adapt it for our age, like Hollis was very much an introductory figure to, oh my gosh, ladies and gentlemen, I have completely forgotten the second Watchman's, or the second Night Owl's name. Hold on, let me look it up.
Daniel Dreiberg.
Yeah.
Daniel Dreiberg. Why? You know, poor Dan. Okay, poor Dan.
I was just going to say, I always remember Hollis's name, and I almost never remember Dan's name.
Poor Dan.
Just remember, it's three letters, Ted and Dan.
Oh, yeah.
God. So, but okay, I would like to see Hollis a little bit more tarnished, because he was always kind of this introductory figure. I would honestly like for them to explore and maybe have a writer do this, like, if he was sort of, like, Regina, like, you know, Regina comes in, and she looks at, you know, she looks at Hollis's, and it turns out that Hollis is just as bad as the guys that they had. You know what I mean?
I think just as bad as the guys tarnish poor Hollis. I think the whole point of Hollis was, but I think the whole point of Hollis was he was true, I mean, he really was a humble guy who really wanted to do it. I think, yes, he was a cop, but I think, I mean, he wasn't a cop all that long. He was still pretty young. And I think it was an extension of his wanting to be a cop. I don't know if that was intended. I mean, I think it would be an interesting story to pursue, yeah. But I don't know if that was, I think the intention at the beginning was he was kind of the moral center and, you know, part of the reason why he had to go. you know, was because he was kind of the moral center.
Too good for this world, too pure. Like that cinnamon roll.
Yeah. But I mean, again, I mean, this is a guy who maybe harbored a torch his whole life, but never settled down. Maybe justice was his mistress, like Batman. But, you know, it's, yeah. I mean, I think nowadays, I mean, we're looking at it when this was written. There were dirty cops, right? Of course, a lot of cops were dirty. We didn't even have a lot of the forensic techniques that we have today. And, you know, people may do, but I don't think there was that. I mean, I think we're in an age where there's just a lot of ambiguity and where it's like they may have always been this bad, but it wasn't, I don't think it was an Alan Moore. I mean, of course, he probably saw corrupt cops, but I don't think it was Alan Moore's intent that this particular one was corrupt.
Okay, do you think we'll see him then? Again, completely unrelated to anything, because I think that the two different sides would tie into a story nicely.
Yeah, I'm not sure we'll even see Dan again. I mean, has there been any hint of Night Owl? There was the ship. We saw the ship once in one of the trailers.
Yeah. Because I remember the Regina King character, she was like reacting to it, I think.
Yeah. So maybe he's been in hiding.
Well, he and Dan and Laura changed their names to Sam and Sandra Hollis. And apparently in Doomsday Clock, they wanted to come and convince Dr. Manhattan to stop being Dr. Manhattan, and that is not likely to happen. So, anyway, I think that, you know, unless anybody has anything else they want to go over as far as Blue Beetle goes, I think that we've covered... Well, I mean, we could talk about Dan.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about actual Night Owl. and we could talk a little about Jamie Reyes and
for the background. Yeah.
Okay. No.
Before we move on, let's do some Jamie Reyes.
Okay. So, sorry.
Hi, kinda... Sorry.
Okay, so basically he was kind of created during Infinite Crisis, which is the same storyline event that Ted Kord was killed in. Well, I think it was like in the tie-in build-up that Ted was killed, but it's all kind of the same saga of story. And if you watched Young Justice, the second season, this, I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, it takes a lot from his run, but it's like a lot of it's the similar, very similar with the Reach and everything. But basically, Jaime, because of all the Infinite Crisis stuff and the DC books, they decided at the end of the story to jump ahead a year in continuity. And there were like some arcs to cover that skipped year, which one of the best ones is 52, if you want to read it. But basically, Jaime, he's like, he was helping them out in space during Infinite Crisis, and he gets back home and he finds out a year has passed. And you know, his parents first are kind of freaked out, but then they're all happy and stuff like that. Like, oh, our son's back, which is good. And really, he's from El Paso, Texas, and he's kind of a normal teenager. If you've read the Kamala Khan Ms. Marvel run, it's tonally quite similar to it in that it's very, like, not lighthearted, but it is kind of like, this feels like a normal kid kind of going through a lot of troubles, both like real life, kind of regular life stuff, and kind of, you know, supernatural superhero world stuff. And it's kind of like, basically, he's very open with his parents. He shows them right away, oh, I'm a superhero, and he tells his friends and stuff. That part's kind of neat to me. I think, like, very, instead of having a lot of the drama like tied into hiding it, he goes ahead and tells everyone, hey, this is who I am. And basically they spend like a good, like, kind of like the first like 15 or so issues really just trying to figure out what is this thing on his back, because basically the beetle scarab basically implants itself on him. And
is it the original blue beetle scarab that is, we now find out, is not magic and is an alien, or is it a whole new scarab?
Yeah, like basically what happened is, well, Jaime, in their search for answers, they come across Danielle Garrett, which is Dan Garrett's, in the DC universe, Dan Garrett's granddaughter. I don't think she existed before this book, but she exists now. So they run into her, and then they kind of exchange information on all this. And it turns out, well, I don't think they found out exactly at the point with her, but eventually they do find out it's the same scarab. And basically what happened is it was infused, well, basically Dan himself was using it as a, basically an energy source. He thought it was magic. Turns out it wasn't magic, but he was using it as an energy source, and that's how he was able to tap into it. But, and then Ted got it and he couldn't figure out how to use it. And then Jaime gets it and it plants itself on him. And basically it is a piece of alien technology, and it was sent to Earth. Well, I'm going to spoil it. I'm sorry. It was sent to Earth by the aliens called the Reach. And because they basically take over planets, you know, creepy alien conqueror kind of stuff. So it was supposed to kind of take over somebody's brain and then have it and have them like kind of conquer the Earth for their species. And when it implanted on Jaime, it was kind of busted because Dan had it for a while, and it kind of floated around in the DC universe, and it said some magic zapped it, some weird energy zapped it, so it's kind of busted. And because it's busted, Jaime can control it, and he's kind of friends with it. And that phrase that Dan used to activate it with, Kaiju Da, they turned it into the scarab's name. It turns out that's the name, and it sent some kind of like mental message to him. This is why he thought it was, like, that's where he came up with it, and why he was using it as like a activation. So when he said the phrase, I guess that's when like the energy expelled. He was like, oh, hey, that's me. That kind of thing. I thought that was kind of like, neat.
Hey, Siri.
Yeah, that is awesome. Dude, that's legit. That's legit. I'm really glad they turned that around too.
Yeah, like, because I mean, like you said, it is like a very awkward Orientalism kind of, let's make up a phrase that sounds foreign kind of thing. So I mean, I guess it's kind of, you can argue maybe it's not much better to make it an alien thing considering the logical, you know, background to it. But I think it's, you know, it kind of fits if you're going to keep some of the lore instead of throwing everything out and just saying, oh, it's completely different now. But basically in the run, though, it just kind of, he meets up with a peacemaker, which you may remember from the comedian episode. Mm-hmm. And the DC version of the peacemaker is, well, not a bad guy. And he's kind of...
The peacemaker was not necessarily a bad guy. When you take the peacemaker to the extreme of what Watchmen put him in the real world, I mean, he wants to... Yeah. He makes war for peace. He wants peace so bad he's willing to fight for it.
Yeah. They actually joke about that line too, but like Peacemaker is basically kind of like, they're not his sidekick, they're kind of teammates for a little while, because basically, as Jaime put it, Peacemaker got the instruction manual in his brain while I got the scabbard on my spine. So like, Peacemaker basically has like all the weird like alien technology and stuff, and he basically seeks out Jaime to figure out, okay, let's figure this thing out, what's going on. So they kind of, you know, hang around a little bit and fight crime and fight the Reach together, that kind of thing. So basically, I do think, like, the way that the series, Jaime's series, was really kind of integrating him into the DC universe. He met Oracle, he met the Phantom Stranger, he met the Teen Titans. Like, he became close with a lot of characters. So, and my introduction to him was actually the Batman the Brave and the Bold cartoon, which is like, I saw that and I was like, oh, who's this kid? Then I went to go see, oh, he has a comic book, and I thought, oh, it's canceled, because literally canceled like within a couple of weeks. Yep. Of airing Great Thing DC.
This is a conversation for another podcast. One we should have.
But I mean, they did keep it. My understanding is they did keep it alive a little longer than they should have. The sales aren't not necessarily there, but it's, I mean, it's a very good series. If you can find it, this is the 2006 run that I'm speaking of. He did have two other runs, the New 52 and the Rebirth. And I mean, they're okay, but the really golden Jaime stuff is 2006. The main writers being Giffen, Rogers, and Sturges. Mm-hmm. And it's just very well done, very down to earth, very fun, and it won't get you sad, and go ahead and read it.
And I think that's the great part of it too, is that you do see all spectrums. You got magic, you got the self-made guy, you got the alien technology, but they're all still, there is a thread that pulls them all together, and it's there's really sweet stories where, you know, it's either Ted displaced from the past, or Ted, the ghost of Ted Kord, or some weird alternate universe. I can't remember what the issue was where he met up with Ted, and Ted was like very encouraging. But it is definitely a sweet passing of the torch, not a bitter one.
Hmm. Aww, I love legacy characters.
You know, yeah, really Ted Kord. R.I.P. to Ted Kord. He was a real one.
So when we talk about Ted Kord, so the Ted Kord and Booster Gold were part of the Justice League International, right? International.
Sorry, I love them.
They didn't do as much saving as they did just being comedy.
Yeah, buddy, the sitcom. Oh God, they were so married.
like you know, playing pranks on each other, and it was just like the internal drama. It was great, but I mean, these were not like, you know, they were not meant to be, you know, the top level heroes. And I think this is kind of, you know, you can see this kind of thing also in Night Owl, in that he is kind of that, he's a hero, but he's also, you know, he's just a guy. And I mean, Blue Beetle at the, you know, during the JLI, he had like a bit of a, you know, a belly, you know, I mean, he was very much like Night Owl, and that he was kind of out of shape. You know,
yeah,
and not at his peak form, and that's kind of where we find Night Owl and Watchmen. I mean, he's been out of it for a while, and you know, he just, you know, he goes and reminisces about the good old days, but he's, you know, not currently crime fighting until Rorschach shows up on his doorstep.
Yeah, I've always been like, when I was like reading it, I was like, what is compelling him to do anything? Like, besides someone just pushing him along, like, he's always been the most perplexing character in how mundane he is, because he just seems to be pushed along by everyone else in the narrative. Like, yeah, we're going to do this now. We're going to do this now. And his costume was the coolest. And I was like, I don't know. I just, something about him was just so, he was just there. And I don't know if he was just there to just, for other characters to bounce their own ideas and angst and things off of, but yeah.
And that's an interesting question. It's like, yeah, so is he there? He's there definitely to be the middle, you know?
Yeah, he's
the
middle,
a little farther to the right, and the right, but he's kind of to be the middle. He ends up, his for me, I'll tell you what I think his motivations are. You guys can tell me I'm crazy, but I think his motivations are, one, managing Rorschach, because he feels a little bit responsible then for him, because they used to be partners. Two, desire for Lori, right? Is, you know, it's he's not really the initiator on that. I mean, she really is taking the lead.
That's what I'm saying. I know. I feel like everyone was the lead. He was just the support. He's supplemental in both of those situations, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I think that, yeah, the Lori thing was all mostly Lori, and he was like, oh, yeah, I'm into it, you know? But it was, he never initiated any of it, if I can remember. And like,
no, he definitely had the hots for her, and you get this feeling,
for sure,
like,
yeah.
You know, he likes her more than she likes him, but at the same time, she pursued him pretty hard.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that's why I was like, it's always interesting. Yeah, I don't know. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I guess it's kind of like good to get that kind of normal superhero kind of perspective, if you want to say that. Because, like, he had some, like, turmoil, I guess you could say, but it wasn't, like, the other people were kind of crazy and very kind of had their own personal issues and all that, and he was just kind of, well, guess we're done with this now, and guess I'll do this. Like, I don't know, I guess it's kind of, like, not every man, but it is kind of a...
Yeah, no, I agree.
What, like, a normal person might react to stuff versus...
Yeah, he was necessary. I definitely think he was necessary.
It was kind of a kink, too. And I think there's, you see a lot of that in The Watchmen, and it's, but I think it was really greatly illustrated in that, you know, this was the thing, he didn't like who he was without the costume. And I think the costume gave him power. And you see Alan, I mean, I talked a little bit about this in the last episode, and Alan Moore, you know, talking about, you know, wanting to be the scariest thing in the room with Rorschach. And I think, you know, here he feels powerless, and that's understandable, you know, that he's not allowed to be a superhero anymore. He has to kind of, you know, hide who he is. But, at the same time, it's like he doesn't like who he is in Rorschach. Again, we talked last week, Rorschach doesn't like who he is. It's his face is the mask. But also, you know, with Night Owl, to an extent, without that mask, he doesn't feel like, he feels impotent, literally. So
do you think since you guys know DC, do you think that Rorschach and Night Owl have a DC and or Carlton counterpart as a team?
Well, they would be Blue Beetle and the Question for sure. If you're gonna go literally, but that's, you have to go into Carlton to read those comics, right? So in DC, you did see Booster and Beetle, right? And the Question was definitely the Question, who had various degrees. I mean, Rorschach is takes it farther, because he's not in a comic book, right? It's supposed to be the real world, right? Whereas, like, you know, the Question, as crazy as he is, you know, is usually ends up being right, and or because Rorschach was somewhat right, you know. He was a bit off on a lot of his theories, but, you know. I don't think the Renee Montoya Question she has her own problems, but I don't think she's quite as conspiracy theory as the original Question.
No.
But I also, the other thing I want to bring up is that, since we know that Jamie might have existed I'm sorry. We know that Jaime might have existed to, I spend a lot of time reading comic books.
Yeah. <Not saying that>.
So, do we think that maybe Renee, who was also brought in with New 52, was part of that, let's make sure we keep the copyright on these characters kind of move?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, this is one of those things where I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there was a definite passing of the torch when Vic died and gave her the... She basically became the question during the 52, and I don't know. I can't even answer that question, but I did love that saga of them working together, and I was just like, mm-hmm. It was just like really emotional for me. I was like, ah, because my Vic Sage introduction was JLU, and then I retroactively started reading it in the comics. I was like, he's different, but yeah, no, I don't know.
I know they did like they Well, they were going to kill off Dick Grayson, and they didn't do that. And they did kill off Superboy, Connell, because of the right thing. So it's possible, like, everything they kind of created out of that era was partly to do with the right issue.
That one was a dispute over whether or not DC could have rights to a Superboy character that was not Superman. Because there had been another Superboy character that wasn't part of the original Superman deal, and then that had to be settled. And that's why you saw poor Connell is out. He's back now, and we also have Jonathan, so so now we have a surplus of Superboys.
I was going to say, yeah.
We need to bring back Chris Kent while they're at
so many Superboys.
I wonder if they will, if we can have the saga of the Superboys. We'll put that out there in the universe.
I'd buy it. I mean,
I would.
You know, John, Mr. Bendis.
Bendis, if you're listening.
Right, he will be. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting that you guys bring this up. Can I ask a theory question for you guys? Mm-hmm. You know, I can't recall Marvel ever having an issue like this, or at the very least, if they have, then I've completely missed it. But DC starting this year. Yeah, okay, there you go, Captain Marvel. But honestly, if you think DC was kind of the original, it seems like DC really started the idea of the legacy character. Do you think that Marvel picked up on that?
For sure, absolutely.
Yeah, so let's, all right, I'm going a little aside, and then we'll come back because we've got to get back to Sub Spectre because we're coming up on an hour. I'll do my little aside. Is it like because I'm a little bit older than you guys, and I was a kid when Crisis hit, and honestly, everything then started to go to Legacy, and it was really hard when Crisis hit, but then we got then you got Wally West, who was the Flash, and he was a great Flash, and he for an entire generation of which I was just the start of it. And then for another 24 years, Wally West was the Flash. There was no Barry Allen.
Still the Flash to Wally, me.
Exactly. And this drives me nuts. This is 24 years worth of childhoods. Wally West was the Flash. And then, of course, Hal Jordan had his meltdown. And then we got Kyle Rayner, who was a great Green Lantern because he was an artist and he got to use his imagination. And everyone's like, all right. And we accepted that he was the Green Lantern, or at least, you know, everyone from my generation on, and I'm pretty old now, accepted him. And that was for a very long time. He was the Green Lantern. And then we had Connor Hawke, who was Green Arrow's son, became the Green Arrow. And he was great. I mean, maybe that one was a shorter run, but I mean, it's still, you know, we're getting legacy heroes from moving on. You know, Dick Grayson was going to become the Batman in your head. And he's like, so you're thinking that we're moving on. And this was like one of those things where it made sense and it felt right. And you mourned the passing of the past. But it wasn't the first time it had happened. Like Alan Scott was the first, you know, Green Lantern. So you see, all right, so every, you know, so many years we get a new one and it was fine and you became attached to them. And then and some of this I liked because like Jeff Johns brought back My Legion and I like that.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of this, we need to go back to the Silver Age heroes that ended up really erasing some great characters, some great story, and some great development that they'd done over the years. And again, we then had another accelerated need to relaunch. But this generational thing was working for DC, and Marvel had just, you know, I mean, the X-Men had been the X-Men for forever, and so their timelines just kept being readjusted. The years thing to happening, like, you know, like with the Punisher, the years, the wars that he was a veteran from kept moving up, right? You know, in the year that Charles Xavier started the X-Men kept moving up so that you could keep them kids, and so that the past was just truncated. But yeah, they never seem to move on to the next generation. And now you have stuff like X-23 and Honey Badger and you know, passing on of the torch. And yeah, to me, that's acceptable. Rather than retaking existing characters and rewriting them, I obviously am much better, like, you know, Miles Morales, for example. I really love the idea of letting it be himself. And I'm telling you, my children... Miles Morales is their Spider-Man, right? And they're like, you know, Peter Parker's okay, but, you know, when they're listing the powers they want, invisibility is top on the list. And I can show you pictures of my daughter for Free Comic Book Day. She dressed as Miles, and they both love him so much. And it's just like, you can make a new character for that generation, and then keep the old one, can be still be there in, you know, in the shadows or in the past or in retro comics or in whatever. You don't have to, you know, keep them. But I mean, again, you know, I'm not going to say that I don't like having my childhood characters back, but we were okay, right? Wally West was the Flash, and to now pretend that he was just Kid Flash or doesn't matter or he was a bad guy all those years is bizarre to me.
You're right, though. I was like, even as like a newer reader, younger reader, to me, like, I like the legacy. I like the fictional universes having their history of, well, this happened and this happened and this happened. But for some reason, I know DC in particular is just kind of, well, we don't want them to be too old, or I don't know why they do it, actually. I can't.
They like number ones. It.
Well, they like the sales, but.
Yeah.
But I have no idea. Especially in Wally West, where he is everything that everyone knows about the Flash right now came from his run. Mm-hmm. And yet look what they're doing with him. I don't get it. But
No comment. Barry Allen and Jay Garrick are my Flashes. I like Wally West, but Jay Garrick does not get nearly enough to do. Everyone's whining about Wally or Barry, but Jay Garrick is the Flash. Like, they could have stripped his head out and be like, he's Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash. This is now the Flash. No, Jay Garrick is the Flash. Like, his legacy, I just feel like, doesn't get enough due. Don't get me started, because I just read this entire history book, and I'm very pressed about Jay Garrick. It's fine.
I too am mildly pressed about Jay Garrick, however.
I can't talk about it right now, but I just feel like people just go back and forth about Wally and Barry and Bart and all this stuff, and I just feel like Jay Garrick always gets, like, I don't know, he doesn't just, anyway. Talk about legacy.
Bart,
I love the Flash family.
Bart
legacy.
Allen.
Oh my God. Bart Allen. Yeah. I love Bart, but Jesus Christ. I had to watch Bart die as the Flash. Okay. I read that thing. I was like, this is terrible.
They brought him back.
God. Anyway. Yeah, I know. I read that too. I know. That was the best. I'm sorry. I could talk about that all day. Anyway.
I just wanted to be like, the Legion's going to say, we really don't want to bring back any more Flashes. Can we just stop killing them?
Right. Yeah, seriously. But if they do that for Young Justice season 4, I will be so happy. I won't talk shit about anything ever again. I swear to God. if they do that, I will, the Lightning Saga, I would be so impressed. Anyway.
So for those that aren't watching it, we'll do a real quick list. Like, at the last episode of, and it's kind of a tiny, tiny spoiler, at the last episode of this last season of Young Justice, close your ears real quick if you don't want to hear, they showed a waitress with a Legion ring on. And of course, the Legion was responsible twice for bringing back Flashes from the dead. So there is that hope. And I really have this hope that the Legion's involvement in the next season is to bring back Wally West.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I'm so excited. Hopefully we're not all gassing each other up.
Like, we'll just fan write it. We'll write the whole thing. I know.
I'm like, it's got to be April, right?
In my version.
Oh man,
we're so off topic.
I know.
I'm just sitting here. I'm taking this all in. But you know what? We're all off topic. I can swing us back by saying, so now that we've discussed legacy characters, let's talk about Silk Spectre.
More legacy characters.
Yes.
So again, Silk Spectre. So I don't know who wants to talk about Dinah and Laurel. And you know, not to be confused with the copious number of characters that are on the Arrow show. The original Dinah Lance was Black Canary for the JSA, and then her daughter Dinah Laurel Lance is the Black Canary that we know today. And she, you know, kind of was in the was kind of the teenager in the Justice League in the 60s. And, you know, as a teenager, really a teenager, she was dating Green Arrow, who was probably in his mid 30s in the 60s. And so there was some similarities between that relationship and Laurie's relationship with Dr. Manhattan here, where him being a much older man. Kind of cradle robbing, and also her being legacy. So there's a lot of different aspects. The kind of, you know, sexy fishnet costume,
the yellow.
Yeah.
Oh wait, I'm gonna interrupt very quickly. The first Black Canary, Dinah Drake.
Oh, sorry, Dinah Drake, married.
Dinah Drake. Yeah.
I was trying to remember the name. I think Captain Lance is her married name, right?
Yeah. Lance is her married name. Yeah, Dinah Drake, and she married Captain Lance. And they had Dinah Laurel Lance. And I think we saw Captain Lance did die later. You see Captain Lance from Green Arrow show, right? But I just remember that from Batgirl. I believe that happened in Batgirl year one. I could be wrong. I will look it up and cut this out if it didn't. But that was a if you guys haven't read Batgirl year one, it was a very good trade paperback pickup if you have the time. Anybody else want to talk about Black Canary?
I love her. She's great. I do. So something I just read. I've been like literally binging Birds of Prey. Like I read the one from like, I think 2011. And then I went back because I'm like kind of like on the new 52 right now. So I went back and really from 1995, read the one shots all the way through. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm in 98 or 99. And so one of the things I recently read was she got dosed with something. I can't remember. It wasn't Scarecrow something. It was something else. But she... Or no, they were experiencing the underworld, and she had this message from her mom. Her mom was there. It was an apparition that was pretending to be her mom. And her mom was just being so cruel to her, saying like she couldn't find her own identity, so she just had to pick up her suit and be her. And it was just this striking thing because it reminded me so much of Laurie's struggle with her mom and this whole idea of legacy of like our parents wanting us to be who they are, and then kind of resenting us for being better than them or not being as good as them or whatever. I think that those lines are so starkly drawn. I didn't even realize that they were, one was, you know, based off of the other until pretty recently. But that's why I think that the motherhood of legacy, which is never explored in comics at all as much as fatherhood and like legacy and fatherhood.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, it's like basically just Wonder Woman and Black Canary.
Literally, that's it. Wonder Woman and Black Canary, that's it. It's insane. I mean, there's probably more, but it's the big ones. It's we don't have enough legacy and motherhood because even the big guys, even Clark and Bruce can't even have daughters. They have sons. Like, you know, anyway, so.
Yeah. No, it's so one of the things I'll point out, we were talking off the air earlier about Black Lightning and Anissa Pierce. Mm-hmm. And Anissa Pierce in the comics, her original costume was modeled after Black Canary, even down to the blonde wig, because yes, she was raised another Justice League baby. Mm-hmm. And Black Canary was really like an aunt to her growing up. So that was, you know, she had to find a female role model to kind of model what her, and she wasn't telling her father at the time what she was doing. Mm-hmm. So, and you saw that on the TV show, they did that, they showed that costume as well as like her first costume on the TV show.
Yeah, I was
so
glad. I love like, that.
That's the costume. And, yes, but they don't, you know, the thing they left out was that the reason why she did that was because, right, Black Canary was not a blonde until fairly recently. Mm-hmm. When it just became like, you know, Ms. Clairol is too easy to get, right? So, so they just have her bleacher here now. But originally, and for a long time, she had short black hair
that she covered
with a blonde wig. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Gail Simone for my only real
That was. Yes, Gail was the one who had her start
dyeing her hair. Yeah, literally, I literally read that. I was like, "Oh, that's why she's blonde." Okay, it was like a light bulb went over my head. I was like, "Okay."
The wig is an interesting thing, though. I kind of like it as a gimmick because, I mean, then you really have a secret identity of sort, mm-hmm, even though she's like almost a child star hero kind of in a way. But
also, Silk Spectre incorporates the wig. Mm-hmm. Lori's hair is not that long hair in the movie. Or in the comic, if I recall correctly. She has different color hair.
I think it's also more poofier. Like, I feel like it's straighter. Like, I don't know if it was a wig, but it definitely had a different quality. There were two other Kane now wears a wig. She has short hair. And mm-hmm, wears a long red-haired wig to hide her identity. And Barbara Gordon also originally, in the 60s, especially on the television show, was also a short brown hair covered by a red-headed, mm-hmm, wig. So that's my wig story, sir. All right, we should probably talk about Watchmen. Just a little bit.
Welcome to the Watchmen podcast, where we talk about
Blue Beetle and Black Canary.
Well, it's good to know where you're coming from and all of these different references. And absolutely, you see a lot of people talking about the Watchmen and making the wrong references, and it starts to lose its potency when you've confused, you know, who it's supposed to be making commentary on, if that, mm-hmm, makes sense.
Yeah, like, because I think a lot of like the casual viewers, they probably think Night Owl is just Batman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely, 100%.
That is what I thought. I thought Nightman. When Watchmen, Nightman. When my stepmother
said, Nightman. So cute. She said Nightman.
Nightman.
Owlman are completely different characters.
Okay. Because my thing, if we're briefly touching on that, you guys, it is important to listen to our podcast, because when my stepdad first had me read Watchmen, and yes, he had me read it at like 12. So everybody get your moment out. But so I read it, and he was like, the simple fact of the matter is, it's what if Batman couldn't get it up? What if Captain America was insane? And what if Batman couldn't get it up? What if Captain America was insane? And what if Superman just didn't care? Mm-hmm. So understanding where these characters come from and realizing the depth and the level that Moore went to is something that will help you understand the stuff that we're talking about. And I had a point that I was going to make about...
No, you said something and I need to take a note of it, because when we talk about Doc Manhattan, I have to say that right now. The
Superman,
I find that fascinating because of their origin stories. That's interesting. We'll talk about it next week. Anyway, continue.
Yep. No. It's because you have these very fascinating characters, but what Moore did was he really crafted these very common superhero tropes that people are very used to. But it has its roots in the essence of the medium. So I'm going to take this moment, folks, to just dive into my, because I'm sitting here and I'm waiting for it, just to dive into my Watchmen After Dark segment and tell you about
it. Oh, God. We've been ready for this.
Wait, right before you do, because this may be a great segue for you. So right before you do, I'm going to bring up the fact that the other one that I think we couldn't remember earlier that she was inspired by and besides Black Canary is Phantom Lady.
Oh, yeah.
And Phantom Lady is another character that, like, she's especially, you know, Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters, you know, she's a really cool character, especially nowadays, but a lot of her character is the super skimpy costume. Yeah. And I think so that is definitely, you know, big on the mind when you're talking about that, and in the costume for Silk Spectre actually has a lot of similarities to the Phantom Lady costume. It has to be on purpose. So that's a good lead in, knowing that she, you know, was designed after a character with probably one of the sexiest pre-modern age costumes ever, to talk about the original Silk Spectre.
Because now that we're talking about Tijuana Bibles, I have to bring up a strange note of something that I just discovered. Naturally, folks, sometimes our notes, like I have pieces of notes that I wanted to talk about, but sometimes our notes get a little lost. So you keep your computer open and you read it. And I just realized that the Phantom Lady comics were published by the Eisner and Iger Studios. And this is hilarious. Eisner and Iger Studio. And if you know I don't shut up about the fact that I work for Disney. So basically, Eisner and Iger are two of the CEOs, and they published one of the most scantily clad women. But no, and I'm sitting here and I'm reading these names and I'm like, wait, what?
I think it's two different people.
Yeah. It's two different people, but like, wow.
So weird when the names come out like that.
There may be no relation, but it's yeah. I don't think there is, because I think that's the Eisner, that the Eisner Award is named after the one who wrote The Spirit. And okay. I don't believe there's any relation to the CEO, Disney CEO Eisner.
It's but just that
me,
one.
Listeners, correct me if I'm wrong.
It's very just the irony of all of it. Before I get into Tijuana Bibles, I will give you guys a very, very brief couple of notes about Phantom Lady. Phantom Lady first appeared in Quality's Police Comics number 1. If you've listened to the Swamp Thing podcast, you know that Wendy and I talked about how. We missed the Swamp Thing podcast. Wendy and I talked a lot about how most comics were related to crime and superhero and horror and stuff that was kind of not mainstream. You know, it's kind of gross and you didn't really talk about it. It's important to keep in mind as we get into what the Tijuana Bible is. So Phantom Lady first appeared in Police Comics, an anthology title, which also included the debut of characters such as Plastic Man and the Human Bomb. And she was the debutante daughter of U.S. Senator Henry Knight, but doesn't go into her origin story. So she's essentially, she's not Wonder Woman, but she kind of looks like Wonder Woman, but she doesn't have any powers. She is just she's just a freedom fighter, and she can drive at night, and she can do all kinds of really crazy stuff. But it was the very first, you're seeing the foundation of her characters, like, you know, Black Widow, and you're seeing the foundation for all of these other characters that would become more well-known as things progressed. Phantom Lady, though, was also built on, can somebody find out for me really quick when Wonder Woman was created?
Oh.
I know it's like the 30s, right? But...
Yeah, 1938.
I want to say 35.
I believe it was 38. Hold on. I got my book open, guys. Okay. Wait, no, it wasn't 38. It was 40s. Hold on. I believe it was the 40s. No? Hold on. I kind of just Googled this. I'm sorry.
No, it's totally understandable. No,
you got the Google Wonder Woman and it gives me the movie page.
It was definitely before 1940 because the JSA was referring to her as their secretary, which is fun. But no, yeah, 1938 or 1939. So I think it was 1939.
One of the things that, okay, so 1939, Phantom Lady didn't appear until the 1950s. One of the 1950s, specifically 1941. So consider Phantom Lady.
41 is also Wonder Woman. I just uploaded it up.
Okay, so yeah. Poor Wendy's gonna have to cut to edit this.
I'm sorry about that. See how crazy we are.
We totally knew. 1941.
1941. Got it.
This is a great segue because Phantom Lady appeared in 1941 after Wonder Woman. And Phantom Lady is considerably more, and I will give Wendy some images to put up on the blog. She's considerably more busty. She's considerably more leggy. She is definitely not. Wonder Woman was very noble appearing, but, you know, and Wonder Woman is just a noble character in general. Phantom Lady was none of these things. And that leads into the Tijuana Bibles. When you talk about comics, you have to talk about pulp comics. And there's the idea, the difference between the glossies and the pulp comics when comic books are created. Pulp comics are made with cheaper paper, which means that they're cheaper to sell and they're easier to produce. Pulp comics are normally made by people who want to talk about the things that the comics code couldn't talk about. So, in the midst of the Great Depression, everybody wanted to try and find something to read. And they went to the underground comics known as Tijuana Bibles, which are not the precursor to the comic book. The first comic books first appeared in the 1800s, or at least the first comic strips. But the Tijuana Bibles sort of led into the paperbacks. And they were solely the responsibility, or at least the initial person who generated them was a gentleman named Mr. Prolific. Doc Winter, William Randolph Hearst's comic artist troubleshooter. Prolific could mimic any artist's style, produced hundreds of Tijuana Bibles between 1932 and 1937. He is an unsung comics innovator, and his parodies of comics characters directly influenced the creators of Mad Magazine, as well as Robert Crumb and the underground comics revolution of the 1970s. Mr. Prolific's Tijuana Bibles have been continually reprinted for over 70 years. So...
You see this nowadays with doujinsha, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Is it, which is like the porn versions of manga, and they get the art exactly right. Like, so you start reading, and you're like, oh wait, no, this is not the actual comic. but I mean, you don't see that as much with people because the quality and the art style of American comics. Is they put the kind of the coloring and the inking, it's all very high notch. The paper is all very super high quality. You're paying $4 an issue, and in other countries like Japan and Korea, the comics are done in black and white with no color, and sometimes printed on newspaper, so it becomes harder to know the difference. But it is interesting that yes, at the time when, you know, regular comics were printed at a very low quality, it was easier to make the fake kind of dirty versions of the comics.
It's you know, if you want to tie it into something modern, you can also sort of tie it into fan fiction. Mm-hmm. People have been writing fan fiction since Sherlock Holmes, since Arthur Conan Doyle, and in its own way, Mr. Prolific and Wesley Morse, who was famous for the Bazooka Joe comics, his 1939 World's Fair Tijuana Bibles are some of the most popular and collectible, but he's used to doing syndicated comics as well. The idea is that these are porny, these are pornographic. This is the kind of thing that you would see drawn about Phantom Lady, who was based on Wonder Woman. You know, these are pulpy creations of characters that seem noble, but have sort of a darker underside.
I'm going to say contemporary to Wonder Woman, just because I don't know that I have abs that she's exactly inspired. I think it was a character archetype at the time, but definitely much more. I mean, Wonder Woman was also very sexy at the time, and there was a lot of bondage in her books as well. Mm-hmm. So I like, this is pre-code, guys. This is all pre-code. If you actually go and look at old Wonder Woman's and old Phantom Ladies, they are very suggestively adult. Maybe not as much as the Tijuana Bibles, but they are not, you know, geared towards children. But go ahead.
You talk about the Tijuana Bibles, and they were dirty, and they were, you know, you'd have people having sex, and you'd have people getting pegged, and it was basically porn. But it showed that there's definitely a darker side to comics, that we're already a pretty dark industry, and that's important to talk about with Watchmen, because Watchmen characters are comic book characters, but they're also kind of low-tier comic book characters, and this just shows that they can go even lower. And Moore makes a specific reference in both the comic and the film to a Tijuana Bible that was given to Laura, or to Sally Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And that just goes to the dichotomy in terms of being female, for me as a non-binary person, of having a woman openly embrace her sexuality and having it be considered something so negative was very interesting, because there's no reason necessarily. I'm about to be called a pervert, but that's fine. There's no reason necessarily to be afraid of anything like that. It's just where you put it in your life. It's not something you show kids. It's all about making sure to think cognitively. Obviously, it's not something you show kids. It's not something she'd show Lori as a child or anything like that. But, you know, she was already kind of a risque superhero, and then people brought her even lower, but she embraced it, and she thought that it was kind of a cool little thing that she did. And honestly, as a kid growing up, I never saw necessarily a problem with the idea that you would be, that, you know, if it's a memento of your life, you'd have that. I never saw a problem with that, just because it was like, okay, well, that's just comics. And I read Watchmen at a very young age. I read Watchmen at a young age. I read Frank Miller at a young age. And the idea that comics had this tie-in to something that was slightly perverse didn't necessarily, I mean, I just thought that was what they were. So to have them, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so I'll go back and be the old person again. So to go back to where kind of feminism was in the 80s. And so I think, you know, obviously Watchmen is not a work of feminist literature. Right. But we can say that Lori was the 80s woman and her mother was from the 50s, 60s. And there is kind of this idea, and this still exists today, where a woman's value is kind of tied up in her and men wanting to have sex with her. And that was very much Sally Jupiter's, you know, value of herself was kind of based around that in a lot of ways, which is why she ended up back with a comedian, was she wanted him to value her. But again, even in the Tijuana Bible, and definitely with the way that the comedian treated her and how she responded to that, it is not one of female empowerment per se. It is one of very much like wanting, you know, getting your value from being objectified and wanting to be objectified, or even wanting to be abused on some level, or wanting to be submissive on some level. And Lori was kind of the 80s woman who's very much rebelling against that, is you want to be the sexual person. You want to be forward with your sexuality. You don't, and of course she is with a much older man and kind of a kept woman, but we can talk about that a little bit if you want to, but you know, it's more of that kind of, you don't want to be objectified. You want to be, and I mean, you know, this may be coming full circle, but it was definitely that feeling that like you need to be empowered and taken seriously as a hero. Whereas definitely Sally Jupiter's whole act, was one, I mean, down to like her catchphrases and whatnot, it was very much one based around her being the attractive woman. I mean, the way she fought crime was that, not Lori, well, but Sally.
No, not at all. But let's talk about Sally for a second, knowing that, because you mentioned it coming full circle, and I would argue, I would be very interested to hear, and I will admit if I'm wrong, from everybody, I would be very interested to hear if that's the way you choose to get bad guys, then that's not a problem. Mostly, I've been reading up on the rights of sex workers, and I've been reading up on the right. This is definitely Watchmen podcast after dark, you guys.
Yeah.
I've been reading up on the rights of sex workers, and I'm just curious as to, like, you know, if you make a conscious choice to do that, do you guys think it's still objectifying?
Sally Jupiter, to me, is a walking contradiction. She fully believes in some deep subconscious way. Well, she did at one point, and it burned her, the traditional structures of family, like men support the wives and the family structure and all that. And it completely fell apart for her. It broke for her. She still in some way sort of deeply, weirdly believes that, but it's also protecting her kid from the harsh realities of everything she does is trying to protect her kid from the world. And then she's also this crime fighter before the kid, which is so fascinating to me, because it's like someone who believes so deeply in men, she had, I don't know, I'm trying to articulate in a way that makes sense. She was a hero. She at some way, shape, or form, yeah, she did it for attention or what, she loved the attention, blah, blah, blah. But she was a hero. She still saved people. And it feels like a kind of a contradiction to her, I don't know, her more conservative or traditional ideals of what a woman's role is in a man's life. So I've always found her fascinating. And I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Oh, no. She was very focused on her publicity, though, and her manager and her... So to how much... This is a question for the group. Is to how much do we think that Sally Jupiter was in it, like Night Owl, to be to save people and for justice and whatnot, and how much was this a woman who was not getting work as an actress realizing that she could
get is she publicity. Booster Gold? Is Booster Gold based on her?
Like, oh, that's interesting.
I mean, if who is a hero still a hero if he does it, do it for money or for personal gain? Like, that's I think that's the deeper question. Like, I don't personally see it as an issue if she got publicity and got book deals and stuff out of it. I don't know. But I guess it depends on your definition of hero.
No, it's not so much an issue. Like, I don't think that, Sally Jupiter was a hero, but I think the question of the matter was, her kind of in her motivations for it. And it kind of this all goes back to the fact, is it this her self-esteem that she feels like she only has value if men find her attractive? And you do hear her say things, and this was a very much of the time, and you can still, there are still people who, around now who think that that's where a woman gets her value is.
Yeah, she was terrified of aging. She very much was raised in the era that your beauty and your youth is of the utmost importance to any woman. That's it. And I get that. Carolyn, your question, can you repeat it for me again? Because I want to like make sure I address it. I think I don't know if I got off topic.
No. I think, okay, now I have to try and remember because you...
It's about owning your sexuality.
Yeah.
It's about owning your sexuality because on the one hand, she's very much a product of that particular time period. If you've ever had somebody, especially somebody female, who was raised, and this is even before you, Wendy, it's even before you, was raised in
before
the 40s,
my time.
Before your time, because my stepmother was raised in the 40s and the 50s, and they're female women, observing this as a non-binary person, women who were raised in the 40s and the 50s have a very specific way that they act, they talk, and they look. Mm-hmm. It is in their own way, and it's not good because it's a sort of societal brainwashing. You have to, like Sally, always be really thin. You have to mm-hmm. always be smiling. You have to always be looking a certain way.
Like a step for now, wives kind of.
Exactly. Thing. And that always to me was so fascinating against the fact that she picked up crime fighting,
Mm-hmm. Does everybody know Hedy Lamarr?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So no, Hedy Lamarr, I don't know, there's a great documentary that was on Netflix, and I don't remember the name of it right now, but I'll go look it up later and post it on the blog, but about the life of Hedy Lamarr. And Hedy Lamarr, of course, if you watched Legends of Tomorrow, there was a Hedy Lamarr episode, but Hedy Lamarr was brilliant and kind of raised by her father to, follow whatever passion she felt at the time, and she was also extremely beautiful. And she got a lot of, power from being the beautiful woman. She always felt that she needed to have a husband. She got her money by selling her face, but she also was an inventor and she was constantly inventing. I believe that, the phone I'm talking to you on right now, I'm talking through the Wi-Fi line, is because of work that she did that was mm-hmm. almost stolen from her from the U.S. government. If you don't know the story, I would say look it up. But she, as she started to age, became kind of ashamed. She could no longer, get a new husband. And she ended up, kind of living as a hermit alone in an apartment, not even talking to her children because she didn't want to be in public not looking like the way people remembered her. Yeah, and I think that's that very much is like Sally Jupiter, is that kind of, mm-hmm. I may have been something amazing, but my value was, you know, in my face and in the men I could get.
Not that she really believed
that, yeah.
No, it's true. Okay, so here's the question that I want to pose as we discuss Sally, and to an extent as we discuss Lori. Wendy pointed out that Lori is very much, you know, sort of a modern woman and owning her power. What I'm finally trying to get at is Sally keeps her mementos, even her dirty mementos, even the mementos that people would say degrade her. She keeps all of it. But because she saw herself as beautiful and she saw herself as this, is her accepting her role and accepting her beauty and accepting all of that a form of empowerment or a form of self-abuse? Because I know I'm bringing the tough questions tonight, because she is...
It's not an easy answer.
I guess
I'd say it's kind of, it's helpful for her personally, but like,
yeah,
as like a standard that other people should do, it's not like positive, it's not healthy necessarily, but yeah. It helps her get by. She's made it that far, you know. Hard to complain with her, you know. I'm not her,
I agree. I think it's a coping mechanism part for the most part, and I wouldn't recommend that as a healthy coping mechanism, because at the end of the day, your self-worth should not come from what other people think of you, like, or your, yeah, but that's so much easier said than done.
But Lori owns her sexuality, right? And that so on the one hand, I'll put this other, is that Lori does run from man to man, literally. But also, yeah, she knows she's not being satisfied by Dr. Manhattan.
She's in charge, you know? Yeah. It feels like it's her story.
Yeah. And she wanted this, you know, this is, she saw the man she wanted and she went after him, and she knew what she wanted out of the sex. And it was, you know, that to me was more sexually empowering. You still have to know that she got kicked out of her apartment when Dr. Manhattan left, and you know, they no longer, we had a reason to keep her around, so she went to find another man to live with. So that is kind of her mother's MO, but at the same time, you know, she does go out and take what she wants sexually.
Exactly. So we're slowly progressing from this idea that the only value that you have comes from what other people think of you, so you may as well as embrace it and use that to empower yourself, to the idea that you can make your own choices and your own decisions. Where do you ladies see this progressing to, either from Sally or Lori's perspective? Who would you say is in the right, but facing these particular situations, what would you do?
Well, this is 35 years ago. Okay. So I'm going to say that even Lori's perspective was 35 years ago, and I would hope that in this day and age that a female hero would have more value in her value as a hero. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And like, you can still go and if she still want to get with Nidal, that's fine, but she should still be, you know, in her own hotel, like trying to figure out her, you know, trying to deal with how is she going to get Dr. Manhattan to not leave the earth, because in all honesty, that was definitely something that was supposed to be her impetus in the thing, is that to save the world, even though, yes, it was her man. She just kind of, oh, well, he left.
I kind of view her when she left Dr. Manhattan and like went to Dan. I almost forgot his name. Poor guy. I just feel like everyone, no one is out of her control. I don't know. I just feel like there's more in control in her perspective than is out of her control. Like, Dan is easily manipulated by her. Like, he's not, yeah. Like, she ran to him and she was like, like, but like she recognizes that he's like obviously attracted to her and will literally follow her around like a puppy dog. Like, it's not that hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that she took advantage of that. I'm not gonna lie, I think she took advantage of their whole relationship. I feel like up until almost the end was her kind of manipulating him and taking advantage of him a little bit. So I feel like for the most part, she was in control of a lot of things. I think she was very empowered and using what she knew from what she picked up from her mom and what she looked at from the world around her, what kind of power do women have? And the way she interpreted it was a little bit different from her mom. Her mom,
but not much.
Not much, but I think I recognize it because she was, you know, I recognize it because that was kind of like, Lori's like, not my mom's age, but like, I see that as kind of a generational divide, is that not many women feel like they have that power, but they're starting to, and they're starting mm-hmm. to feel like they're breaking out, which I feel like was kind of the 80s. Obviously I wasn't alive in the 80s, except for the last year of the last decade. But I feel like that was part of that, was kind of figuring out how to use that, the expectations of women and perception of women to their advantage. And that's, I feel like, what Lori represents. And it may not be the best way to do it, but I also feel like it was, for me, more relatable and more understandable than Sally's perspective. But I also understand the generational divide, because I'll never understand a white woman's plight during the 40s, period, because I just don't understand, because there's just a different grade of it.
Well, I think you're talking about like more like the 50s. In the 40s, a lot of women to step up, right? So in the 40s, you have a lot of women. Like my grandmother, you know, during World War II, she followed my grandfather around as he went from training to training to training in the army. And it's just like, that's, she had to keep everything together and make it work. And my, you know, it's like they had a lot of power, and then the men came home and they were told, it's your duty to give up all your power, which is an interesting reaction. But again, I mean, the 80s, yes, owning your sexuality, using that as a tool to get power, with, you know, Dynasty Dallas, right? There's a very big theme in the 80s. I think, you know, you looking back on it now, it's like I'm hoping we have come to a point where it's more about seeing the value of yourself as a woman. You know, if you want to go out and have the partner of your choosing and get what you need out of the relationship, that is something that you do that is not connected necessarily to your value to society as a whole. Does that make sense?
It totally does. No, I'm offering, look, I'm offering these perspectives because truthfully, I think that, I'm trying to ask these questions because truthfully, while I think that there are people who put both stock in both answer, I think both characters are absolutely fascinating. And unfortunately, you guys, what you're going to get out of me, as far as most of these characters, is an astonishingly disgusting degree of Hufflepuff level empathy, because I'm going to sit and look at all of them except for Rorschach, and I'm going to go, "Oh, I need to save you." So I'm preparing everybody listening to the podcast for this now by warning you that the people you want to listen for, you know, concise and constructive criticism as well, are my other three hosts, because I'm learning so much and it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, the last issue of Doomsday Clock has made me very critical.
We're going to let Wendy rant at the end of this.
No, we'll wait till next episode when we're talking about Dr. Manhattan and Ozymandias, because they are both responsible for breaking my heart.
I feel like this is unfair because I'm not going to read this, and I just don't know. I can only talk about my experience from the fucking novels and the novel.
Listen, you and I can sit together and we will watch, and then we will comment and we will laugh
I can just allude to it in a sense, because I mean, the honest thing is, what I'm most fascinated with, obviously, is Ozymandias, because you guys, everybody who knows me knows that I'm always about the super smart characters who are 10 steps ahead of everyone else, and who people always think are either, you know, are not going to solve the problem, or are who are going to mess up, or, you know, don't have everybody's best interests at heart, and they do. And of course, Ozymandias is, and also, you know, the fascinating discussion is kind of on the morally ambiguous choices, and we can talk a lot about next week about making difficult choices, which both Dr. Manhattan and Ozymandias did. That is Watchmen. right? Doomsday Clock is another animal. There is a level of sadisticness that is coming. I'm going to say it's coming. I hate to say it because I love Geoff Johns, but I feel like something's happened and he's lashing out maybe in this book because it is just very mean-spirited. But again, like when we were talking about to kind of, there has to be a separation in my head between Watchmen
And like other else. Interpretations.
Yeah, right. And stuff that came later that uses the Watchmen characters. Because it's a different time, it's a different story, and they're being used for different purposes. But yeah, so that's, so do we have anything else to say on Silk Spectre?
Just to give you guys the brief rundown of Laurie's character, at least, since I dove into Sally. I think it's just because I cosplayed her at one point. Sorry, everybody.
You've done a lot of cosplay.
I have a TikTok, kids. Everybody follow me on TikTok. So Lori's character is that Laurie grew up. Laurie's the legacy hero. She grew up in her mother's shadow. Her mother kind of forced her into becoming a crime fighter. It's definitely a more familiar role for most people. She was sleeping with Dr. Manhattan. She started the relationship with Dr. Manhattan when she was very young. Good on you, Dr. Manhattan. Good on you. And she didn't really know that the comedian was her father, but I think the comedian kind of suspected, possibly knew that he was her father. Because Sally had retired after having Laurie, and so she kind of blamed Laurie for... blamed Laurie but never blamed her to her face, so she was very much a stage parent with Laurie, and it warped Laurie a little bit to think that she had to go from man to man to realize that, you know, she didn't really need anybody, which she never kind of realizes. She's more kind of focused on staying with Dan by the end of it. Dan and Laurie are the only sex scene in this that is not uncomfortable to watch. I mean, it's uncomfortable, but it's not uncomfortable to watch. They team up. They're a pretty good team. Ultimately, the two of them have to decide to keep Ozymandias and Dr. Manhattan's secrets, both in the movie and in the show, or in the book. And by the end of it, they've taken the names Sam and Sandra Hollis, and they fly off into the sunset and pretty much do absolutely nothing, despite Ozymandias completely manipulating the state of our reality. So we've talked a lot about how these characters are, none of them are really good, none of them are really bad, but Night Owl, I think we can all agree, guys, that Night Owl and Silk Spectre, in both iterations, since they're both technically legacy characters, are probably some of the most reasonably adjusted,
the least objectionable.
Yeah.
Yes, they're objectionable, but they're not. I mean, so they're apathy and they don't. I mean, again, they maybe Laurie moves the plot along a little bit more, but I think neither of them is really trying to save the world. I think Laurie is doing other stuff, and Dr. Manhattan says, "Hey, you got to come save me now."
You know? And we may even explore, since I think they confirm, I don't know, it's all muddled, but that the Laurie Blake that we're going to be seeing on Watchmen coming up on HBO is Laurie Jupiter, Laurie Jeskosik, that's taken on her dad's last name, and I'm so interested if that, I'm assuming that is her, because I haven't really confirmed it but everyone is guessing it's her.
I am really interested. The first thing she does is make a joke.
Yeah, and like literally every trailer I've seen, I've downloaded and skipped a lot of the trailers. Every time she's just cracking jokes, she's snarky, she's sarcastic, and I'm like, that is Eddie Blake's daughter. Like, that is interesting to me that they're going with her. She's weary, like, I don't give a you look ridiculous. Like, I don't care about your rights. This car looks ridiculous. You look ridiculous. This is insane. I don't care what this is. Like, I already love her, and I'm just like, I've always been a Silk Spectre fan, like both of them. I've always been like generationally love them both, if even if I have my own issues with them. So I'm very excited to see where the show takes her and what's the hell she's been going through the last 30 years. If, you know, and where's her homeboy? Where's if they rode off in the sunset at the end of the, you know, at the end of the series, where's Dan? So I'm curious, if, you know, we saw his ship crashing. So I'm just very curious about all of this and how, you know, the Silk Spectre legacy continues.
I'm excited.
What is a flashback and what's currently happening?
Yes. The Hooded Justice scene, when I gifted, I was like, I'm pretty sure this is a flashback. Because I saw it and then they panned away and he's on the screen episode. So I was like, but maybe it's a, like an episode of a television show and they're like doing like a Justice Society television show, but it's like, or not Justice Society, oh my God, the Minutemen television show. and I was like, ooh, basically the same thing. And so I was like, I'm really excited to like see the first episode and just see what's real and what's not. I just can't wait. I'm like really like geeked out about, especially this last trailer, just like all the new footage and just a little bit of Lori and Angela's back and forth. It just gets me really excited that the series mm-hmm. seems to be centered around them, and that makes me excited because they seem to be both chaotic in their own way.
I'm hyped. I'm 150% hyped. Everybody thank Vanessa, by the way, because she is making all those gifts that you guys are seeing on our Twitter feed. Don't forget to follow our Twitter.
Yay. Watch me talk. Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's it.
Okay. Yeah. So you can email us if there's stuff that you thought we got wrong or that you didn't like what we said, go ahead and email us at watchmentvpodcast@gmail.com. You can post a comment on our website, watchmenpodcast.com. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can call us at 918-200-9103. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at watchmenpodcast. And on Twitter, you can find us at Watchmen Talk. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher Radio. And we always love it when you give us a rating and review and let us know how we're doing. Watchmen Podcast is part of the DC TV Podcast Network. So if you are interested in other DC TV shows, you can check us out at Batwoman Podcast, Black Lightning Podcast, DC TV Classics, DC's Legends of Tomorrow Podcast, iZombie Radio, Krypton Podcast, Stargirl Podcast, Supergirl Radio, Swamp Thing Radio, and The Flash Podcast. You can subscribe to DC TV Podcast on Apple Podcasts and follow DC TV Podcast on Twitter and like DC TV Podcast on Facebook. Until next time, tick-tock, tick-tock.